This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Linguist John McWhorter moonlights as a commentator on issues of race in the United States. For the past several years, he's spoken out on Ebonics, reparations, and black leadership. His new book is a collection of essays that challenges both white and black Americans to re-examine how they think about race and the role of victimology in race relations. Instead of emphasizing the remnants of institutional racism, McWhorter argues that African Americans should celebrate their considerable successes. Later in this program, Bob Garfield joins us with a look at the Super Bowl showcase for the advertising industry. But first, Authentically Black, Essays for the Black Silent Majority. John McWhorter's new book addresses racial profiling, the reparations movement, black stereotypes in the media, affirmative action, and more. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. John McWhorter joins us from our bureau in New York, and welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
The central thrust that runs throughout all of these essays is an idea that you describe as double consciousness. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I have never experienced a black home or seen a black home where black parents pass on to their children an idea that black children are victims of white's racism. In general, among each other, it's not my experience that black people emphasize that racism prescribes our lives or that we are perpetually under the boot of someone else. But there's a sense that I think a lot of us operate under, and it's usually a tacit sense, that in order to do the right thing for black people, to be an enlightened black thinker, what one is supposed to do is cloak the race in victimhood when it's a matter of making a public statement. There's a sense that whites are to always understand that they are still on the hook for our fate, and that therefore there's a certain kind of theatrical refraction of the truth that we're supposed to propose when whites and others are listening. There's a dissonance between this and the way I highly suspect most African Americans actually feel in themselves. And the essays in this book address a lot of themes, but the one that I kept coming back to was this kind of double consciousness, which I think is a new version of the kind of double consciousness that W.E.B. Du Bois referred to 100 years ago in one of his books.
And what was he describing back then?
Well, what he meant was that black people felt that they were torn between being white or European, you might put it, and being what was then often called a Negro, or perhaps the African soul, and that there was this sense of a dissonance between the two, and that we were dealing with an identity teetering between these two things. Nowadays, I think a lot of African Americans, I would say most African Americans, have a similar kind of double consciousness. You are to be the victim in public, but self-empowered in private. And what worries me about this is that I think that, for one thing, it creates a lot of dissonance between the races. The reason that the race thing can be so difficult and so tricky, and I think to many whites counterintuitive, is because there is a sense that many African Americans have that they're supposed to stress residual racism and victimhood, and I would venture sometimes even to exaggerate it when whites are listening, despite the fact that often even simple empirical evidence suggests that a person might want to feel differently today. And I think that it also, what's important to realize is that this double consciousness is based on a sense that the fate of the race hangs on whites knowing that they're on the hook. And that's understandable, but I think we tend to forget how many wonderful things black leaders are doing in communities today to help the segment of the black population that's left behind. And these things are not happening as the result of a brand new Marshall Plan for black people or a new civil rights revolution, which is what I think some people seem to be waiting for. What worries me is that I don't see any evidence that that's going to happen. But I think that the change is happening from within, and I think that the need for that double consciousness has passed.
You write about it at one point. You say, the sad fact is that racism is what we really need to be talking about, leaves the idea with blacks today in the position of pre-Copernican astronomers. In other words, denying an intellectual fact.
Well, yeah, what I mean by that is that we've often been taught, I'm 37 at this point, many African Americans my age, maybe 10 years older in particular, have been taught that what we need to be looking at is the eradication of racism, the idea that anybody has any bias against us. The way I see it is that eliminating discrimination was extremely important. Eliminating residual racist bias is something to work on, but I think it's not as important as we often think. I find myself often remembering that there is not a country in the world, and probably hasn't been throughout history, where there wasn't something or isn't something going on that we would call racism or bias or discrimination. Sadly, it's a human universal, and I'm not sure how we could ever have a United States where all whites had nothing but the purest and most egalitarian feelings for blacks in their hearts. Now, that's sad. We work against the things that we see. But I think we need to get beyond the idea that until there's no residual racism, then we're still mired in a pit of despair. The idea is for us to achieve as much as we can, despite the fact that people are biased against us.
And wanted to get to racial profiling, which in the one of the essays you describe as the one thing that today will not let Americans get past the race issue.
And why is that? Main obstacle. There is a tendency, because of the things that I just talked about, to focus on the bad over the good. That's the main issue. Nowadays, there is so much improvement in so many ways in the black community that it's not as easy to do that as it once was. But there's one thing that's going on, and it is a genuine problem, it is a genuine outrage, that I think helps preserve this kind of victim mentality, and that is the fact that there is such a hideous relationship between particularly young black men and police forces. Now, I do say in that essay that in many black communities, profiling is necessary in order to keep other black people from getting killed, but abuse by the police and inappropriate bias against black people is the main thing, I think, today that perpetuates the notion that nothing has really changed in America since 1960. And I do believe that until we get rid of a certain iconography, which is now firmly imprinted in the minds of a great many black people, that the police are engaged in a war against black men. And there are all sorts of shadings and nuances that we can dwell on that issue. But as long as that iconography is there, and it's partly correct, although I wouldn't put it in those terms, then we can't get past race. Because if you ask an African American, why is it that you feel that racism still persists today as badly as it did in 1960, only it's changed? One of the quickest answers you'll get is one out of three young black men are either in jail or involved in the criminal justice system. This is passed along as a kind of a meme, if you will, in the black community. It is a very serious obstacle. Anybody who says we just need to get past race and everybody needs to just stick their chin up doesn't understand that until we get past this police problem in particular, nothing will happen.
One issue that erupted, obviously, since you finished the book was the entire Trent Lott affair that really happened in the course of just last month. But you do address what white politicians say in public and in private, their double consciousness, if you will, and that these are statements that matter.
Well, one issue is that we African Americans have a tendency to only vote for one party, and the reasons for that are understandable. But the problem with that is that if we all vote for Democrats, Democrats have no reason to do anything for us because we're a shoo-in, and Republicans have no reason to do so because, as many of them have privately told me, how much energy are we supposed to put forth for people who won't vote for us? Now, that's a particularly disempowering proposition today with the Republicans having all the chips as they do. And more to the point, the idea that the Republican Party is full of racists kind of represents what I'm talking about how we frame racism. So, for example, how Trent Lott happens to feel about black people behind closed doors doesn't really concern me. It doesn't hurt me that that man might not respect me. It seems that if black people are a strong people, we have to get beyond that idea that we're supposed to cry whenever we see this sort of thing going on. What is important is whether or not his quote-unquote racism would affect the course of legislation. And in that particular case, I thought there is no way that the majority leader, when both houses are Republican and we've got a Republican administration, should be somebody who doesn't get the race thing. I don't think Trent Lott is a racist, but he certainly doesn't seem to think of the Civil Rights Revolution as a priority. That's somebody who has too much power. But in general, how Republicans feel about black people in their hearts is less important to me than what they are going to do for us in exchange for our votes. I think we've lost a sense of that kind of political paradigm.
And I think we're speaking, I think there's either today or tomorrow a conference gets underway in Washington, D.C., where Republicans are going to be studying how to address the issue of the minority vote. If the Democrats and Republicans split the same way next time, demographers say that Republicans would lose next time around.
Yeah, and what I would really hope is that the Republicans will come up with a clear way to explain to engaged African Americans that the things that they want to do are really in a position to help. And so for this is just a simple example. Many people think that we're going to solve the problem of the inner cities with lots and lots and lots of money, and then perhaps child care and some transportation. We've had many variations on that over the past 40 years, and it seems that a certain core of the inner city always stays the way it is. Now, the Republicans proposed the faith-based and community initiatives, the idea being to give churches access to money so that they could help these communities help themselves, which is really the only way that most human societies ever actually help themselves. That was a very pro-black measure. I think that tended to get missed in our national dialogue because it wasn't made clear enough. It's this sort of thing. I think the Republicans could get more votes if they used a real Madison Avenue, clear, charismatic way of explaining what benefits they offer our people.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is John McWhorter. His new book is Authentically Black, Essays for the Black Silent Majority. And let's go to Kara, who's with us from Oceanside, California.
Yes, thanks for taking calls from California, people.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that I did have the benefit of affirmative action when I was in graduate school from 96 to 99.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought of myself as a victim. I still don't think of myself as a victim because as a Christian, I tie it back to the Hebrew story of the Hebrews leaving with reparations from their Egyptian oppressors. So I look at it as historically it's the same thing.
John McWhorter?
Well, the way I see it is that affirmative action is a wonderful thing if one has been disadvantaged. I understand that. We're a capitalist society. Capitalism, in my view, is the best of many evils, and with all of our money, we certainly need to compensate for it by giving a leg up to people who have had a hard row to hoe. My issue is that if one was not socioeconomically disadvantaged in any particular way, then we have to start asking certain questions. And I guess people will differ as to how appropriate reparations are, how far back in time.
Well, I look at it as, you know, again, I wasn't, we didn't miss meals. We, you know, I had both a father and a mother, that type of thing, brought up in a Christian home, but yet and still, as a people, I think I was disadvantaged, that sort of thing. And
oh, you mean group was disadvantaged.
Right. And, right. And it also goes down, you know, into my family and that sort of thing, and you can see the, you know, the stratification. And I wanted to, if I could, just say that I was accosted by a white classmate, you know, when I was first accepted into the program, who, you know, said, I don't think that you should have affirmative action. I don't think it's fair, you know, to just base it on race. And what I said to her was, have you passed the GRE? And she had taken the GRE. She had not passed it. I had passed it with flying colors. Therefore, you know, it was appropriate for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess a lot of us will differ on whether we want to base our identities on individuality or a group. Personally, I try to generate my sense of esteem, or whatever you want to call it, from inside. I have a hard time feeling that particular kind of group placement that you do. But as far as that classmate, certainly things like that will happen. And it's certainly not that a person who benefits from affirmative action who did not suffer doesn't deserve to be there. But as I've argued in many places, the problem with lowering the bar for an entire group of people, and that's separate from legacy people, etc., entire race, is that you end up perpetuating the kind of performance that you were trying to improve.
Kara, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with John McWhorter about his new book, Authentically Black, Essays for the Black Silent Majority. Back after a short break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're speaking with John McWhorter today about his thoughts on African Americans. His new book is Authentically Black, Essays for the Black Silent Majority. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a phone call. 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And one thing that John McWhorter talks about in the double consciousness, as we said, here's a moment that was quite widely broadcast from last summer's movie Barbershop. Some critics thought this scene went a little bit too far.
Three things that black people need to tell the truth about.
What?
One, Rodney King should have got a beat for driving drunk and being grown in a Hyundai. Two, O.J. did it.
O.J. did it.
And three, Rosa Parks ain't do nothing but sit her black down.
That's
right, I said it.
John, there was quite a controversy after that scene was in a very popular movie, after that scene was talked about.
Well, yeah, and of course there were some other lines that took to task certain black leaders in rather disrespectful ways. And that controversy actually demonstrated a lot of what I'm talking about, in that there was a feeling among, for example, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, that there was no room for the general public to be presented with that kind of dialogue among African Americans, despite the fact that there is a lot of talk like that in black barbershops across the nation and at black Thanksgivings and black gatherings. Actually, black gatherings are often rather conservative affairs. Everybody knows that. But there's a sense that you change your language when you go public. That barbershop scene was actually, the movie, in many ways, was an eloquent testimony to that. So that controversy does not make it into my book because it was after press time.
Right.
But still, it demonstrated the first essay beautifully.
Yeah, an example, as you said, of the private conversation that all of us got a glimpse into for $8.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But it's there now, and you've got DVD, and who knows what the added scenes on the DVD are. I haven't bought it yet.
Again, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Robert, who's with us from Constantine, Michigan.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
I'm finally through. I want to make a comment and then perhaps end with a question. The more I listen to your guest, the more I think I actually do associate with him quite a bit. I'm African American, biracial, actually, and 29 years old. And in my early 20s, I used to go to a friend's house in a large town nearby and get my hair cut. And there'd always be five or six guys down there just going off about the white man. I mean, just some of the words, some of the rhetoric that I heard from them just kind of turned my gut, and I eventually just quit going over there. I was actually friends with the guy that was the kid that was cutting my hair, but as I quit hanging out there more and more, I realized that I don't associate with that feeling, and I moved out further into the country and got a good job now, and so when I hear like Jesse Jackson and Sharpton and some of those guys speaking for what would be the collective voice of African Americans, it really enrages me, and it's good to hear somebody that maybe I'm actually Republican, because I guess I feel like the Democratic Party and Jesse Jackson and those guys just they don't really represent for the right reasons their race of people, and that's I guess my question too is how he, you know, like I don't hear Jesse Jackson praising Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, and
mm-hmm.
Associate with them. I mean, that's really where I feel I fit in, and it
it
makes me mad when I see some of the stories about Jackson. And
it can be infuriating. Although I think that the people who accused Jackson and Sharpton of just being interested in lining their pockets are really creating a kind of a drama that's not quite the case. What it is that those are people now of another time, in a way, and they are very much caught up in the sense that to be black is to be a victim, that victimhood and alienation are the core of the race. Now, that certainly made sense based on our history. As far as I'm concerned, anybody who indulges in that kind of rhetoric as a sport who's over about 55, I get it. You know, you speak the language that you learn. But
that's
I think
right.
that people our age realize that the world is changing. And really, Jackson, Sharpton, people like that, what else would they do? It's the only language they speak. But what's important about them is that we call them black leaders because they're on TV a lot, but really they're not leading anything, and there's a lot of wonderful black leadership that's on the local level, people who are not national names, who are doing great jobs. And this is what's important. This is something people tend to miss. There are no new Al Sharptons. Many Al Sharptons in various states are being voted out of office, and there's no rising black star right now who acts like that. He's a man of another time. He's not going to die today, and, you know, I wish him well. He's going to be around. But those people are anachronisms. We are moving on to a different kind of race future, thank God.
Robert, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for the guest today. It's very enjoyable.
Okay.
Thanks, Robert.
All right.
Let's move now to Ann, who's with us from Vista, California.
Yes. I have a question. What kind of repercussions have you had in the black community for being a little bit outspoken in regards to the culture and you know, the mindset of if you're not a Democrat in the black community, you've almost, you know, turned your back towards your own black community. I know that Alan Keyes has had a lot of repercussions, number one, because he's a Christian, and that's another whole topic, but he's pretty outspoken, too. And how many black conservatives are there not getting support from their local communities and the churches? Where are the black churches? I mean, they're basically conservative, but they're very quiet in backing up somebody that's outspokenly conservative. And I think it's for fear that they would lose maybe part of their church.
There were problems with the cell phone, so I just repeat the beginning of Ann's question, which was, what about repercussions for you from the black liberal community? No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, actually, the truth is that there will always be certain African Americans who are deeply offended to hear any kind of black rhetoric that strays beyond the left and the alienation routine. And it's understandable. They can't help it, and those people will always be there. But actually, I found, and one reason that I think times are changing, that actually I have felt embraced by the African American community as a whole since I started speaking out on these things about 3 years ago. There are a lot of people who are ready for a new message. There is a growing movement of black conservatives. As they go, I would call myself one who leans pretty far to the left, but there are many who are much more to the right than me. It's getting there. The churches are an issue. The black churches actually do preach a very conservative ideology in their way. What we're trying to do is cure them of that double consciousness that the public face has to be one of victimhood. And I think it's gradually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And
thanks
very much for the call. We appreciate it. Now let's move on to talk with Pat, who's on the line from Boulder, Colorado. Hello, Pat, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air.
Facetiously, I think he should change the title of his book to The Vocal Minority. I happen to be a white woman, and I happen to believe that what he's done is he's acculturated to the major, a culture. We were taught this in sociology. And what he's done is he has adopted the values of the white culture. As a consequence, he's lost the perspective of the minor culture, which talks to diversity and is absolutely necessary if this planet is to survive. And so what I hear him speaking could be spoken only by someone who was brought up and raised in the predominant white Anglo-Saxon culture. And as a consequence, I think that what he is saying needs to be really filtered, because he is not acknowledging the reality of what happens to majority of the black people in this country. And it's very similar to the conflict that is happening now about war. We are getting such doublespeak and such nonsense about two consciousness that nobody can use their common sense to assess what is really going on.
Well, the he she was referring to is John McWhorter, who is a you, actually, but go ahead.
That's an interesting perspective, but it would be a more likely analysis if there weren't a great many African Americans who have had the background that I think this person would consider authentically black who agree with me. I'm not speaking, I don't think, as a kind of peculiar minority opinion. I'm trying to speak to what I think of as a growing sentiment that I think needs to be aired more. Diversity is certainly important. We're not against diversity. And uplift is certainly important. But I'm not sure that the model that the previous caller might, I'm just guessing, might prefer for what sort of statements black people should make in public would actually be helping anybody, diverse or poor. Or at least that's the way it seemed to me over the past 35 years.
Pat?
Well, I just disagree with him strongly, and I think what he needs to do is he needs to take himself to some of the ghettos, whether it's on the East Coast or the West Coast, and experience what authentic black people are going through.
Well, you know, actually, the truth is that I did grow up with a social worker mother with very left-leaning politics. I went along with her on her job, and actually there are things that I do today on the side that pretty much fit that description. So whatever our disagreement, it's not that I don't know how people who aren't in my position live.
And do you honestly believe that the view that you espouse is going to help, and not just the black, but other minorities, other diverse cultures in this country, to achieve equality?
Yes, I do.
Eliminating some of the laws that helped create that diversity and helped create you, I would dare say, to achieve what you've achieved.
But this is what's important. Affirmative action, when it's applied to disadvantage, is a sensible thing. But the question is, when do you end it? Now, some people would say that you end it when society looks exactly the way it should in terms of demographic proportions. That's understandable.
And it doesn't.
But actually, well, wait a minute. Let me finish. But wait, I'd like to finish my sentence. However, the fact is, when you're dealing with something that involves learning a skill or a set of skills, there comes a point when incentive is the only way that a group of human beings will do it. So that's the basis of my view there. I firmly believe that the views I'm espousing are designed to help, not just to spout rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just like they're trying to make English one that only English is spoken in the schools now. And you have a lot of immigrants who are coming into this country that I dare say are yards, miles in intelligence ahead of the Americans here, and they are going to be disadvantaged because they're not going to be learning in their primary language, and it's the same thing. What I hear you saying is that you want everybody to come from the standard, and I don't believe that it's even the best standard as the majority in this culture, which is white Anglo-Saxon. And that's where I disagree with you, and I think that you're creating a problem by espousing your view, and I think that when we assess behavior like Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell, that we should look at them very carefully, because I think that what people will discover is what they're doing is they're following the energy of power and the energy of money and expressing nothing but greed, which is the major characteristic of this white American culture.
Pat, we'll get a response, but I wanted to thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Oh, well, actually, very important to remember that it's not that I have any problem with changing standards somewhat or doing everything that we can to help people who are disadvantaged rise. That's not the issue. I don't say that everybody ought to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. My issue is more specific. Do you apply these things uniformly to a group of people of one skin color when these days there are more middle-class black families than poor ones, as quiet as it's kept? And as far as the greed and the power, like I said before, in my view, capitalism is the best of many evils. And I don't see people like Condoleezza Rice as selling out. I see them as doing the only possible thing that they can do in the only country that we African Americans can ever consider home, diversity or no diversity.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear now from Eric, who's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I am very happy to hear the gentleman, Mr. Warden, is that correct?
It's John McWhorter, yes.
Warder, thank you. Thank you for the pronunciation. To actually describe how we are different in personality, there is no one identification or description or characteristic for a black person, and I really enjoy that. There are so many points I'd like to comment on, but the one most important I would think would be politics. I consider myself a green independent Republican. Now, I say that in jest, but seriously, because I think that when we automatically give our voting bloc or our voting power to one party, we give away the leverage that we have to
precisely
really make a difference in the things that we need changed in our community. When we have over a $500 billion a year buying power in this country, and we mm-hmm. don't see the returns, the investments in our communities that we need, we're doing mm-hmm. something wrong as a people. And I think we need to really consider that point and to look at each candidate and what they bring to the table and vote accordingly. And I just thank you for your guest and for the show today. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Eric.
Thank you, Eric. And, you know, one thing that has to be said is that ethnic groups using the machine in that way is not as simple as it would have been in 1920, but it still can happen. We have to realize that to utilize the power of our vote, we have to get beyond worrying about the racial psychology of many of the people who represent the party and think about what these people can do for us on a meat and potatoes level in a country where we can assume that there will always be some sort of residual racism.
Toward the end of your book, John McWhorter, you lay out some new ways to think about solving some of the problems as you see them. We just have a couple of minutes left, but I was wondering if you could walk us through one or two.
Well, actually, I think that one of the things that we really need to do is, for one thing, consider this voting issue. And I would say that, in general, I think a lot of us would be happier, and I think that we'd get further in our general race debate if we could question a sense we have that there are certain occasions where we are supposed to turn it out, so to speak, and to play the victim. In general, I think that we would be better off to think of ourselves more as victors than victims without being Pollyanna-ish about it. And the way I see it is that I'd like to see a kind of a change in context, a change in the way that we discuss these things. There's no magic bullet, but I think that African Americans are justifiably afraid at this point, after all we've been through, that if we let whites off the hook, so to speak, that there's going to be some sort of vast backlash, there's going to be some sort of slip-up. But I ask a lot of people to consider, what has any evidence of that slip-up been? I would beg to differ that the gradual demise of racial preferences or the refitting of welfare programs has been a slip backwards. But people will argue on that. But other than that, I don't think that we have to fear this backlash anymore. I think that we've done very well for ourselves and that we can start bringing our identities into a kind of a wholeness that we don't have if we have the victimhood routine that I think we're often encouraged to play. So my advice at the end of the book and throughout the book is a matter of a change of attitude. I think that it's time for a new paradigm, and I think all of us know it.
John McWhorter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
John McWhorter is the author of Authentically Black, Essays for the Black Silent Majority. He's also a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. When we come back, we'll talk with Bob Garfield about his picks and for the winners and losers in the Super Bowl ads that were broadcast last night. Which were your favorites? Which ones did you hate? And which spots made it clear that you're no longer in the advertiser's target demographic? Give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.